This building podcast is brought to you by Fenwick Elliott, the construction and energy law specialists. To find out more, go to www.fenwickelliott.com. Hello and welcome to this latest building podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Harris, Buildings Digital Editor. Coming up on today's show.
You know, we're running out of time, so we need to take action as soon as possible, not wait until it's been, you know, proven, tried and tested.
Julie Hirigoyen of the UK Green Building Council on why construction needs to step up and tackle the global climate crisis head on. Also coming up.
Problems arise because once work's up and running, there's just less commercial incentive to greet anything outstanding and put the formal contract in place.
Fenwick Elliott's Dave Bebb on letters of intent in construction. How do disputes arise and how can both parties avoid them? That's a taste of what's to come in this episode. Stick around. First up today. With climate change firmly front and centre of the agenda, the construction sector has been urged by activists and campaigners to confront the issue. With the built environment making up half of carbon emissions, there are plenty of ways to make construction more green. Julie Hirigoyen, the chief executive of the UK Green Building Council, told Building that the time to act is now.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really timely moment to reflect back on what has happened over that sort of past decade or so. I was actually musing on the fact that it was back in 2007 that McKinsey published their very first kind of carbon abatement curve. They're called MAC curves, mitigating actions and the cost competitiveness of different actions that you can take. And even back then, way back in 2007, buildings were the most cost-effective measures that we can take to decarbonising our economy. So it was things like, you know, energy-efficient lighting, insulation, decarbonised heating systems, etc. And it's taken a really long time for us to come back to a point where we were actually looking at that sincerely again. We had we definitely had a lull in the 2015 really was when a lot of the green building policies were sort of dumped. And in the run up to that, actually, UKGBC was also set up in 2007, back in the day of those MAC curves being produced. And for the first sort of 8 years of our existence prior to my time here, but we did some really progressive work with government on kind of co-creating some of the built environment policies around zero carbon new build, Green Deal or pay-as-you-save mechanisms, various energy efficiency policies and so on. And come May 2015, about a month after I took over the reins here at UKGBC, a lot of that was just bonfired. And I think the zero carbon new build policies were the most regressive, actually, to have bonfired those because it caught a lot of criticism at the time. But the industry had really been working up to that for like the best part of a decade. So it was really getting ready to deliver that. And the costs of delivering it had come down and so on. So I think we definitely had it quite it was quite high on the agenda. Then it dropped right off. Mm. And now it has come back. Whether it has come back with the various other kind of issues on the political agenda taking all the airtime, such as Brexit and so on, it's challenging to see beyond the sort of the big ambitions that are being put out, but there are definitely some big ambitions being put out by government.
Absolutely, and that sort of comes on to my next question, really, because obviously this lull and everything sort of being curtailed almost all at once, it's sort of, particularly for the construction built environment industry, they really do need that level of support, don't they? Particularly from government and even the wider economy. Do you feel that you or the industry more broadly are getting that support now?
So I think that's also a really good question. I think what's absolutely needed is long-term certainty and consistency and clear trajectories of raising, ever-tightening standards so that we can, and as you quite rightly point out, it takes a long time to change a building throughout its life cycle, and it takes significant capital investment at different points. So one needs as much lead-in time for that as possible. And on the new build side as well, what will we be building to in 5, 10, 15 years' time? some of those schemes are already on site, you know, some of those plans That's already. Right, yeah. So it is that long-term certainty is even more important for this sector than any other. We don't yet have what we need. We do have the big intentions and ambitions have been put back on the table. So things like the clean growth strategy, which has got a sort of EPC minimum band C for all homes by 2035. That's quite a big long-term kind of goal.
Even existing homes? Or
existing homes,
wow, okay. Yeah.
We don't have any of the detailed policy of how we're going to get there. So we've got the kind of, we've got some long-term targets or indicators. We've obviously got the net zero emissions by 2050 now being legislated for. That's great. We need the detailed policy now that's going to get us there. We've got the Future Home Standard, which comes in 2025. That's world-leading standards of energy efficiency for new homes and low-carbon heat. We don't quite know how we're going to achieve that. And some, as we said, some of those homes are in planning now. We've got the Buildings Mission, which was another really positive announcement around the industrial strategy challenges, the clean growth one being one in point where new buildings are due to halve their energy use by 2030, and the cost of bringing existing buildings up to similar standards should also have halved by then. So we've got these kind of big, quite sexy announcements that point in the right direction and that kind of give us some hope. We don't have any of the detailed policy that sits underneath. So we now really, really urgently need that detailed policy to all be knitted together. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'd sort of say on that is a lot of these different announcements have come from different departments, which in some respects is really good because it means there is a cross-departmental commitment to tackling climate change. The downside, if there is any, is that they may not actually sort of knit together very well. So, you know, we absolutely need to make sure that they do, that the building regs review that's coming up later this year feeds in that Future Homes and Buildings Mission announcement, and that we're sort of working to those longer term trajectories. Otherwise, it's going to get a bit chaotic.
Yeah. How does UK GBC go about getting that attitude change?
Yeah.
Further across, why? Yeah, outside the ones that have made these announcements.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. It's multi-pronged and multifaceted. We've got major programs and campaigns at the moment around advancing net zero carbon. That's obviously huge that we need to mobilise and the industry around being able to deliver that over time, and also circular economy, and those two are inextricably linked because the more circular you design, the less waste, the less embodied carbon, etc. But the really interesting bit about your question is around attitudes, and actually, you know, that is what we need. We need people to shift from a mindset that says we can't do this, or it's more too expensive, or it's more expensive, or it hasn't been done before, or it's not the way we do things, to a mindset that says the whole world is changing in this direction, we've just got to get there faster. And climate change isn't going to wait for anyone. So if anything, every day we get more news that is happening faster and it's getting worse faster. The earlier we take action, higher the likelihood that we might actually achieve that 1.5 degree goal that we have, and bearing in mind we're above 1 degree now, we're running out of time. So we need to take action as soon as possible, not wait until it's been, proven, tried and tested in a million places. I think that the mindset shift is something that we're working really hard on here. And the way we do that is through experiences and leadership programs and leadership insights that trigger that sense of personal responsibility and that encourage people to think in a slightly different way about how fragmented the industry is, or how that, so collaboration is at the heart of that, innovation is at the heart of that, and we're taking young leaders, heads of more senior managers and soon to be board executives through these programs to try and accelerate their sort of mindset shift, attitudinal shift. And I'm a big believer that you have to change from within before you change anything outside. So we've got to get these kind of epiphanies happening at scale and right across future to current leaders, which is why I said it's not necessarily an easy task. But
But are you confident, Julie?
I am really encouraged and hopeful by the signs of change that are coming at us from all corners now. And I feel like, the school climate strikes and the Extinction Rebellion people, and now this push for staff to sort of join the children in the street and say to their employers, we want action too. I'm really, you know, I find that quite moving and really exciting. So I'm confident that change is coming, and that it's no longer, you know, we're not going to do this because clients aren't asking for it, or it's coming from within, from people just saying it's not okay anymore. We're hurtling towards the precipice without, you know, any protection. Yeah. So let's sort it out. I find that really uplifting, and I think if you take action, I think Greta Thunberg said this in one of her speeches, which are fantastic, and she sort of was being asked about how optimistic she was, and she said, look, if you take action, you don't really need optimism because you're doing everything you can do to make something change. I'm sort of in that camp, you know, more and more action, and people taking that action, it catches one by surprise. It's like a tipping point of just people suddenly deciding it's not okay. Well, I think the public mood is something that's very, very hard to gauge. And we have seen in the last two to three years some very significant scientific consensus around what is happening and how fast it's happening. So the IPCC report, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that came out last year in October time, that was the 1.5 degrees Celsius sort of report. I think that triggered a huge wave of concern. And this stuff is now becoming more, you know, clear to people, you know, throughout their standard media outlets, through schools, through local councils, through, you know, this move towards declarations of a climate emergency. You know, we've seen 130 local councils now signed up to a climate emergency. Many of the professional institutes, RIBA and various others. So it is, you know, that clearly is responding to that change in public mood. It's sort of okay, 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 and suddenly it's really not okay to turn one's back on it. I think once we know how stark the science is, and we know we can do something about it realistically, that's affordable and perfectly technologically available today, then we really have a responsibility to act. Otherwise, it's, you know, we're neglecting our responsibility as a human species for future generations, apart from anything else.
And you seem remarkably encouraged by everything. And
just to put a tiny reality check on that, I mean, I am confident and I am hopeful. We have a very long way to go as an industry. You know, let's be honest, we're still building pretty crap homes that are, you know, energy inefficient, that are sometimes not safe, that are poor quality and that don't perform very well for the people inside them. That's even on the new build stuff. So we absolutely need to raise our game. We're still sort of making the problem bigger at this point rather than reducing the size of the problem. All of those homes that are poor quality that are being built today, I'm not saying every home is poor quality, but all of those that are will need retrofitting in 5, 10, 15 years' time. Now that's really wasteful financially as well as resource efficiency wise. So, and we're also incredibly profligate as an industry, the construction industry, with materials. And, you know, we use practically or recycle or repurpose our homes and our buildings to be more efficient and effective with space utilization and so on. So I don't wish to paint a negative picture, just a reality check that there's a really long way to go, and we need to do that all very, very fast. Yes, there is movement, there are businesses out there that are really getting it and getting on with it, but there's a long way to go.
Okay. So Julie, what's your call to action to the built environment?
Last week was London Climate Action Week, and in most of the sessions that I spoke at, I talked about the need for action, not words. So every single person working in the property and construction world, you know, right across the whole spectrum, can do more themselves. You know, we all have a home, some of us rented, some of us owned. We all work in premises, in offices, or on construction sites. We can all demand more action from someone somewhere, whether it's a landlord, a contractor, a supplier, a client, an employer, or indeed our own families. You know, we just genuinely can take more action in our buildings, whatever those might be. So that would be my call to action. We think about your interaction with the built environment from a personal to a professional level, and think how you could influence greater demand for higher standards, because we absolutely can all do that.
Julie Hirigoyen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Now, letters of intent are widely used in the construction industry as a way of letting work begin before a detailed contract has been completed. But a lack of standardisation of these letters leaves everything open for disputes to arise. To talk us through the problem is Dave Bebb, a partner in construction and energy law specialist Fenwick Elliott. Dave, thanks for joining me today.
Morning, Jamie.
So first up, I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with the term letter of intent, or LOI, but perhaps for the few who are not, could you shed a bit more light on exactly what they are?
Yes, certainly. A letter of intent is, as the name suggests, simply a letter from one party to the other, usually employer to a main contractor or a main contractor to a subcontractor, expressing a future intention to enter into a formal contract. As I said, it's usually from main contractor, but it does happen also with the professional team. Now, typically, these are entered into at the end of the tender process, once the contractors secure the project, and inevitably the employer's really keen to start on site as soon as possible. In fact, a typical letter of intent, it will refer to the contractor's winning tender. It will then say something along the lines that once any outstanding terms are agreed, and these are not only legal terms but sometimes commercial stuff, the parties intend to enter into a formal building contract. And the emphasis there is on intend to. Sometimes it never actually happens. There's usually also an instruction to start work and an obligation on the employer to pay up to a certain amount for that work. Usually design, but could be long lead procurement. Often not actually, work actually starts on site pretty quickly.
Okay, so on the face of it, letters of intent should be fairly straightforward and recognise the commercial reality of needing to get to site as soon as possible, even though some of the finer points of the deal still need to be thrashed out, I guess. So where exactly do problems arise with these, and why might they come up?
Problems arise because once work's up and running, there's just less commercial incentive to agree anything outstanding and put the formal contract in place. Once it starts, arguably the project team just focus their intention on getting the job done, often to a tight programme. And to be honest, finalising the paperwork that underpins it just gets put to one side, often on the too difficult pile, and yet work cracks on. Now, many projects, of course, formal contracts do get resolved and issues get sorted out, but the industry is still really prone to disputes. Any listeners who've been unfortunate enough to be involved in a construction dispute will be well aware of how much emphasis is placed on the contract. Whenever there's a dispute, the parties immediately reach for the contract. If it's agreed and signed, of course, it's always in the bottom drawer. If the bottom drawer is empty, you end up scrambling through emails, trying to work out what the deal was. You often find that the people who wrote those emails are no longer involved in the project, etc., etc., and it's just a minefield of trying to work out what's happened for the last, often, couple of years under a letter of intent. We've seen plenty of projects. I've got one now on site that's been going for a good 18 months, 2 years under letters of intent. You imagine the number of emails that have been generated over that period of time. Trying to sort through it is a nightmare.
So you mentioned that the courts are littered with cases involving letters of intent. And for those listeners who are fortunate enough not to have been involved in a dispute around these, I mean, could you run through a couple of issues that might have led to those problems?
Yeah, of course. The main causes of problems is that those outstanding issues never get resolved and you never actually finalise the contract. So it's a question of working out what the deal is. Now, right at the top of the list of problems is whether there's a binding contract for the whole job. Remember, letters of intent are intended usually just for an initial part of the work, site setup, mobilisation, whatever it might be. The reality is that often you get quite a lot of work done on the back of a letter of intent. So if something goes wrong, you've got to work out what terms apply. Now, one party might be saying there's a contract in place for the whole project. The contractor might be saying, I've got the whole job. The client on the side might be saying, no, your work is limited to what I asked you to do under the letter of intent. You also need to bear in mind that as well as placing obligations on parties, you see contracts are also there to protect parties. So a contractor looking for the benefit, for example, of a limit of liability for delay, they only get that via the contract. The common law will not imply that, so you get that via the contract. If it's not clear, the contractor doesn't get the benefit of that. Now, one of the leading cases is a case called RTS and Flexible Systems. This was a letter of intent. It was marked subject to contract. Contained an expiry date. Another common feature of a letter of intent is not only is a limited amount of work instructed, there's also a cut-off date by which time the letter of intent falls away. The idea being to incentivise people to get things sorted ASAP. Now, the court held in that contract, in that case, that the underlying contract conditions, in this case the MF1 conditions, they were incorporated and applied. it didn't matter whether the contract said that they don't apply until signed. It's the conduct of the parties said, well, actually, the way you've acted on this project, you've waived that requirement, and those contract conditions bite. There's a great quote from that judgment which we lawyers often trot out when warning clients of some of the dangers. There's a Lord Clark said in that case, having no doubt the parties having spent thousands of pounds on lawyers, he said this: the arguments in this court demonstrate the perils of beginning work without the precise basis upon which it is to be done. The moral of the story is to agree first, start work later. And I must admit, Jamie, I often wonder how much effort it would take to agree these outstanding points, because if you don't agree them now, is it any easier to agree them later on?
You mentioned the word subject to contract. This phrase is very familiar, but could you just elaborate precisely on what that means in legal terms?
Yeah, subject to contract is just a term often used in correspondence between parties to show that they've not yet reached a deal and don't intend to be legally bound. But as I mentioned in the RTS case, the conduct of the parties is really important. You can mark something subject to contract, but if you then carry out 2 years' worth of work and then try and claim there isn't a contract, you're going to have an uphill battle, I think, to argue we're not yet in contract. Often it's the conduct of the case of the parties is really important in terms of demonstrating whether a contract is in place. At the end of the day, whether in contract, as I said, is a matter of the party's conduct. There was a case involving Arcadis and AMEC a few years ago, and the judge in that case said, quite succinctly, in circumstances where works have been carried out, it's usually implausible to argue there's no contract. This is a pretty good rule of thumb. If you mark something subject to contract, do 2 years' worth of work, don't be at all surprised if a court finds that you are in contract, whether you like the terms or not.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm no expert here, but given that these letters of intent seem to cause so many problems, and the quotes you've said before, you know, start, you know, agree the terms now, start work later, I mean, can their use ever really be justified?
I think in my experience, and I've been doing this 20 years, Jamie, they can be justified in very few circumstances. What you have to bear in mind is that letters of intent are only intended to be used where there are bits of the outstanding deal that have not yet been agreed. But if they've not been agreed, it doesn't make it any easier to agree them later on. They just get kicked into the long grass. Now, even if there are outstanding issues, I think what project teams should be asking themselves is, how long would it take to resolve those, getting the right people around the table? As I say, they've got to be resolved at some point in time. You may as well do it now, because the longer you leave them, they simply just tend to fester. Also, bear in mind, from the employer's perspective, its bargaining position weakens as work progresses. Most letters of intent will allow the employer to terminate. The theory is great. The idea is less attractive in practice. It's a very brave employer that has a plan B in place that, having started work on site, decides that actually things are not working out, I'll get the second contractor in to finish. As a rule of thumb, I was always taught, always receive a letter of intent, but never give one. You receive a letter of intent to make sure there's an obligation on someone to pay you for the work you've done. As soon as you give a letter of intent, you more or less have to assume that the other party has the upper hand merely by virtue of work being carrying on site.
Okay, so it seems that letters of intent may well be here to stay then, and it'll take some time really to wean the industry off their use. So with that in mind, when issuing a letter of intent as an employer, what things should the employer have at the back of their mind, and what should that letter of intent actually include?
First, make very clear what work's being authorised. Is it design, long lead work, strip out on site? In reality, the employer is reliant on the contractor to tell them what work needs to be done in order to meet that programme. One thing you notice with the letter of intent, they're not particularly clear on what that programme is. Is the contractor tied to a completion date, or is there a general reference to in order to meet the programme? Very frequently, they're not that clear on it. Second, does that letter of intent incorporate the underlying contract, whether it's a JCT or an NEC, whatever it might be? The fact is that once the job starts, people on site will operate it as if there is a contract in place. Applications for payment will be issued, certificates issued, etc., etc. And for all intents and purposes, the team will treat it as an up and running project. Bear in mind, if that's the case, does that contract bind the parties at that stage? Remember that if a JCT contract is incorporated, it only really works if you fill in all the blanks. So the contract particular section at the beginning requires various things to be filled out for that contract to operate. Liquidated damages for delay is a classic example. If it's not been filled in, what happens if the project is delayed? Do liquidated damages apply or not? There was a case back in 2012, a case called Ampleforth and Turner and Townsend, where work proceeded on letter of intent, but the employer was unable to claim LDs from the contractor because the detailed contract had not been agreed, so everything was up in the air. The employer then turned round and sued Turner and Townsend, saying, "You didn't warn me of the dangers of proceeding under a letter of intent, and as such, I've not been able to claim the damages." Both contractors and employers must assume that the whole project may, and I say may, proceed on the back of a letter of intent. If that's correct, ask yourself what happens if the project is late. Finally, in terms of insurance, if work is being carried out on site, be very clear what the insurance position is. Many listeners will be familiar with JCT in terms of their options A, B and C for how a project is insured, but it's extremely important that that is clarified very early on. Finally, you also get letters of intent that will frequently include a maximum amount that can be spent. What letters of intent often don't deal with is what happens once that maximum has been reached, and actually, does the employer have the right to instruct further work? Letters of intent also frequently have an expiry date in them, so by a certain date in time, the letter of intent falls away. If that happens, can the employer actually instruct additional work, or does the whole right fall away? Finally, you've got to think like lawyers. Your glass is always half empty, not half full. As I've said, you've got to assume that the whole project will be built off the back of the letter of intent. Plug in the worst case scenario. What does that letter of intent say about it?
Okay, thank you for that, Dave. That was really, really concise explanation and very detailed as well. I learned a lot from that anyway. So you mentioned actually just then a case where an employer sued Turner and Townsend because work had progressed on the back of a letter of intent, resulting in the employer being unable to recover liquidated damages. Now, given that not all clients involve lawyers at the outset and often rely on the advice of their project manager, what tips could you give those PMs when it comes to these letters of intent?
Jamie, the advice is really simple. First, as I've said before, do the letter of intent at all. It's the project manager's job to pull the deal together. If there are outstanding issues that prevent the contract being signed, is it the PM's job to get everyone around the table to resolve those issues so a letter of intent maybe is not needed at all? Second, always advise the client that as a general rule of thumb, issuing a letter of intent usually puts the contractor in a stronger bargaining position than the employer. If there are outstanding issues to be resolved, but work is up and running on site, generally speaking, I think it's fair to say the contractor has the upper bargaining position. Finally, don't attempt to draft the letter of intent yourself. I see numerous letters of intent copy and pasted from previous projects and, to be honest, cobbled together. As project managers, you're expected to have a general overview of the law, but you're not expected to be lawyers, so don't hold back at all in suggesting the employer takes legal advice if they insist on using a letter of intent. I think these three steps will go a long way to avoiding the position that Turner and Townsend found themselves in.
Now finally, you mentioned that most letters of intent contain some sort of limit of expenditure and that work often progresses in excess of that limit. In this particular situation, how does a contractor actually recover the price for the work done where they've exceeded the limit in the letter of intent?
This is a really frequent problem in practice. Understandably, contractors are keen to crack on with the work and the paperwork just doesn't keep pace. They can very easily find themselves exceeding the financial limit. Now, before I go into the ways around the problem, as a general comment, both employers and contractors frequently underestimate how much freedom the English law allows them. Now, provided this freedom is written down clearly, English law will enforce contractual provisions. Some listeners will be familiar with time bar provisions. You don't get an extension of time unless you're notified within 21 days. Pretty clearly written down, and they are enforceable. Very similar provisions appear in letters of intent. There may be words to the effect that the employer is going to pay no more than £250,000 under this letter of intent. Where a contractor has exceeded that, they shouldn't be at all surprised if the judge turns around and say, "Which bit of that didn't you understand?" Pretty clearly written down, and the English law will enforce these things. That said, there are abilities to recover above those amounts. What tends to happen is it's a matter of conduct. Does the employer instruct more work above the £250,000 limit? Do the parties act as if the whole contract is in place in excess of that limit? So there are ways around it, but often based on the conduct of the parties. But the lesson to the contractor always has to be, if you're getting close to that limit, do exactly what the letter of intent says. It might say stop work, it might say seek a further instruction, but never assume there's an automatic easy battle to recover the money over and above what's authorised in that letter of intent.
Dave Bebb, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Jamie.
Okay, that was Dave Bebb, a partner in construction and energy law specialist at Fenwick Elliott. Well, that's it for this week's Building Podcast, which was brought to you by Fenwick Elliott, the Construction and Energy Law Specialists. To find out more, go to www.fenwickelliott.com. As ever, please do let us know your thoughts and feedback on this podcast by leaving a review on iTunes or by emailing building@building.co.uk. Don't forget, you can listen back to our archive of podcast episodes from this series and before by going to building.co.uk/podcasts or by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks once again for listening. I'm Jamie Harris, Building's digital editor. Until next time.